Welcome to episode 167 of Behind the Mission, a show that sparks conversations with Sycamore trusted partners and educational experts. My name is Dwayne France, and each week I'll be having conversations with podcast guests that will equip you with tools and resources to effectively engage with and support military service members, veterans, and their families. You can find the show on all the podcast players or by going to sycamore.org/podcast. Thanks again for joining us on Behind the Mission. Our work and mission are supported by generous partners who also believe that education changes lives. Our partner this week is PsychArmor, the premier education and learning ecosystem specializing in military culture content. PsychArmor offers an online e-learning laboratory that's free to individual learners as well as custom training options for organizations. On today's episode, I'm having a conversation with Kate DiBartolo, a senior director for the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and a leader for the Conversation Project, IHI's public engagement initiative to help people share their wishes for care through the end of their life. You find out more about Kate by checking out her bio on our show notes. Let's get into my conversation with her and come back afterwards to talk about some of the key points. Kate, thank you for taking the time to chat about the work you're doing with the Conversation Project, as well as efforts related to the National Healthcare Decision Day. But before we get into that, I'd like to provide you an opportunity to share a bit about yourself and why this work is so important to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. The Conversation Project is focused on helping people talk about their wishes for care to the end of life. We have no preference for the type of care people want, but we really want to normalize people doing this early, often before a crisis. And I have been so drawn to it, not only for the person whose healthcare we might be discussing or somebody's end of life we may be discussing, but the ripple effects that can have for the people around them, for the people who survive the loss of somebody and can grieve their loss. And what we have seen is how powerful these conversations can be for helping people process their grief and not have it be quite so complicated or complex. They're still talking to their siblings. They're not second guessing themselves. And so for me, it's been a really, I know people might think, oh, you work on death and dying all day. But it's so energizing to realize this is something that's universal for everyone and we can make a really big difference here.
I think that point that you just made is you talk about death and dying all day. And I work primarily in suicide prevention. And it's one of these things is it can be a very heavy topic. But as you said, it can be, especially with people at end of life, they're reflecting on their accomplishments, they're sharing with their family. And it can be a really graceful, if it's done properly, but also just uplifting experience to have these conversations at end of life whenever it happens.
Yeah. I've found myself over time, this conversation to me is less about how somebody wants to die. And it is so much more about how do you want to live your life through the end. For us, we're focused on conversations about your values, what matters most to you, not what's the matter with you, but what is it that you would want somebody to know? So if you couldn't speak for yourself, they would be able to talk to the medical community. And we've also found that this is really applicable to people, anybody over age 18. This is not just about, well, I'm not that sick or he's not that old yet. It is anybody over 18. If something unexpected happened in your life and there is a time where you couldn't speak for yourself, what would you want people to know? Who do you trust to make those decisions? And for many people, I think they can actually wrap their heads around that. But that feels like an important thing. And we're practicing using those muscles, realizing we can talk about this, see a TV show. It's, oh, I don't know what you would want in that situation. So it's like, we sometimes joke it should have been the Conversations Project because this isn't just one big sit down conversation. You can never change your wishes. It's more about getting that practice in, not, you know, we know that a crisis is a really hard time to learn. And so what can we do around the kitchen table or on a drive or, you know, at a regular FaceTime call with somebody and not in the ICU at the first time we're bringing this up.
And I think that's very important. And again, as you mentioned, this is a natural thing. Our audience is definitely with populations around military and veterans. And I often say that especially those in the military, it's an inherently dangerous occupation. And so danger is a part of it, right? And so sometimes these conversations are had, but then when somebody leaves the military, it's not necessarily something that is continued. How have you seen this, the Conversation Project, perhaps in military and veteran circles? Have you seen that happen at all?
Yeah, we've seen it a lot, especially as people are thinking about who they would want to choose as their healthcare decision maker. Mm-hmm. That It's also sometimes called a healthcare proxy or a healthcare agent, surrogate. In the U.S., every state has their own language. But it's who's that person that you would trust to make decisions on your behalf if you couldn't do it. And I think particularly in the military veteran community, many times people are seeking each other out for that. That there are community groups. We talk about bringing this to where people live, work, pray, learn. And for many people, that orientation is to people maybe they deployed with or from their same branch of the military or who you have affinity for. That it doesn't just have to be your oldest child or a spouse or a sibling. It can be somebody that you really trust. And so we've seen that for sure. Those are probably the best examples that I would have there.
So we've started talking a little bit about what the Conversation Project is and sort of having these conversations about end of life. But maybe we could be a little bit more specific about the Conversation Project. You mentioned before we get started that you've been with them for 10 years. But what is the Conversation Project in general and how can people understand it?
So the Conversation Project is a large public engagement initiative. It's all nonprofit. Everything's free. Really trying to help encourage people to have these conversations about the care they would want at the end of their life so that those wishes can be understood and respected. As I mentioned, we want these conversations early and often. We have no preference for the type of care somebody may be wanting, but we are trying to get people to talk about their values. And so we've provided a lot of free conversation starter guides in multiple languages to help people think through, what would I even talk about? A lot of people know this is important, but I don't know what to even say. And we might say, okay, on that spectrum of your preferences, are you concerned about too much care or too little care? People will often have a strong opinion one way or the other. We give icebreakers for people to talk about. I would say those listening right now have the best icebreaker of all, or one of the easiest ones. But I was just listening to this podcast. It made me realize I heard about this initiative, made me realize we haven't talked about this. But trying to give people really tangible tools for how to have these conversations. How do you think about who you want as your proxy? What if somebody's asked you to play that role and you don't know what to do? How do you think about talking to a healthcare team? We've got tools for caregivers, somebody with dementia or for a seriously ill child. A lot of people sharing their stories and blog posts. We're just trying to make this thing that a lot of people know is important to do, and yet they haven't quite wrapped their heads around how to get started. To make that easier for people and also to just do things like this, like help talk about this more in the public, have people realize this is something, it doesn't just have to be with a doctor or a lawyer. This isn't some expensive formal process. This can just be starting to have conversations with the people who matter most in your life about what matters most to you.
And when you talk about it, it makes sense, right? It's, of course, this is a conversation that you would normally have. But then as you mentioned, you know, some people, oh, I don't want to be morbid or don't talk about that where there's a time where we're not going to be together or those kind of things. But this is also necessary. I think it's necessary for the dignity of the person experiencing end of life. But also you mentioned it's necessary for the people that care about them because transition is difficult. I've lost my father. My wife has lost her father. And we've all seen a number of different types of transitions that have occurred. But I think that this is necessary, like you said before, not just for the individual, but for the family and those around them.
One of my favorite blog posts was from a gentleman who wrote, like, I have done this because I'm a father and I'm doing this for my kids because this is part of how I want to have taken care of them. I want to help take care of them, help make things easier. We know that the Onion had a funny, like, satirical headline of new study shows death rate holds steady at 100%. It's not to make light of something, but make it a little more lighthearted that this is a universal experience, just like. And we can be prepared. We can do planning. For people who do a lot of other planning and preparations in their life, this is one not to leave up to chance. And that also helping people realize you can have a say in your care. The healthcare team wants to know what matters most to you so they can make recommendations. You can be part of the team. And rather than assuming that they're just going to know what I want, it'll be fine, that these conversations can really help clarify that. And can make things a little bit easier over time for folks.
And I think that, again, as you'd mentioned, making those wishes clear from the individual helps relieve some ambiguity whenever the decision does come and there are multiple people involved. And the multiple people involved, the children, the spouses, or things like that, might have different wishes for personal reasons to prolong or perhaps not prolong care. And again, being able to say, this is what I want ahead of time is really avoiding some of those difficult, potentially challenging conversations later.
And I think it's important. I was saying earlier, it's not one conversation and you can never change your wishes. What matters most to somebody could change over time. So I remember a gentleman in Boston, he was in his 90s, quite ill. He had been cleared. He did not want very extreme measures taken if something unexpected happened. And yet he was admitted to the hospital, full ICU care, getting everything. And his doctor was like, "What's going on, Mr. Brown?" He's like, "My first great-grandchild is due in 2 weeks, and I will do anything I can to be here to meet that baby, and then we can go back to the other plan." And I want people to realize that it's not like you can only say something one time and never change it. The things that are happening in your life may be different, and what somebody feels is worth fighting for, maybe that's going to shift over time. What makes a good day for somebody, or what makes the chance for some extra time worth some additional pain or some limitations? What I want people to really take away is that we're not asking regular people to make a lot of medical decisions about hypothetical scenarios we can't anticipate. I often tell people, think about what you would want right now. If something unexpected happened in your life, what would you want somebody to know now? And I have a colleague who, she set it down to one sentence, basically, for her husband. "If I can emotionally and intellectually parent our children, I'm in. I got two teenagers. And if something unexpected happens and the doctors think that I may have some physical limitations or a long recovery, but I could understand what's going on in their day, I can listen to their social issues and help them with their homework, I would want you to do everything you can to extend my life. But if the prognosis is such that I would not be able to understand what's going on, I couldn't communicate with them, I don't need you to take extreme measures." But that sentence really helps her, in her case of a spouse, be able to think about how he would answer any questions or any issues that come up. For some people, it's, "I eat chocolate ice cream and watch college football," or my dad's like, I need to be on the tractor and walking my dogs. That's, if I can get back to that, I want you to do it. So thinking more about that idea of what matters to you. And if you get a new diagnosis or if there's another thing in the future, you can talk about it again. I think also like moments, like getting married, having a kid, a divorce, a death in the family. Those are all good opportunities to bring this up and not wait again for a big crisis underway.
No, I appreciate that you said that. I'm thinking of, and to be honest, this is actually a conversation that my wife and I have had recently, because I'm in Colorado and there's actually a news story happening currently in Colorado that's related to, around a funeral home that's actually in the national news. And it's a crisis that triggered this conversation. It's a negative event, or perhaps, as you mentioned, it's the loss of a loved one or a sudden loss of a loved one. These conversations seem to occur when we're in emotionally fragile or vulnerable moments or challenging moments. Whereas you're talking about, they can happen outside of those crisis times where it's not too late, but when everybody's open and honest to have these conversations.
Yeah. Mother's Day, Father's Day. Somebody's graduating high school and about to move out of town, having those conversations. Conversations are back and forth. It's not just telling somebody something and they're not ready to receive it. So thinking about the person you're trying to engage, whether it's that you want to tell them your wishes or you want to elicit their wishes, how are they going to best receive this? And I remember a woman who said, she was in Akron, Ohio, and she said that she hosted Thanksgiving every year and she always made dessert. And one year she held it hostage and said, "No pumpkin pie till you tell me how you want to die." Made everybody go around the table and talk about it. And that worked for the dynamic of her family. That would not work for other families. And so maybe it needs to be an email ahead of time. Maybe it's those little bite-sized pieces. Maybe it's more yes, no question. The icebreaker of this podcast. But think about how your person would best receive it. I think that can be important. And also one thing I want to name, we've talked about the idea of giving current answers. A common issue that comes up is, "I want to be at home." We hear from a lot of people. I remember speaking to a woman in Florida who was just in tears because she said, "My grandmother's only wish was to die at home and we couldn't do it. Her dementia got so hard to manage and we had to move her. And I feel like I didn't honor the one thing she asked for." And so I would really encourage people, whether that's your wish or somebody else's, to unpack what that means for you. So I know for my grandmother, who's military and moved all over the world, but like for her, it was her cat that was home. If she could have her cat with her, she was willing to go anywhere. For other people, it might be a private room or family visiting or home cooked meals, or can I put my art up on the wall? But helping understand what that is for someone can be really helpful when certain decisions need to be made. And also understanding how important autonomy is to someone. There are some people who feel like, "I want you to do everything I say, no matter what. This is really important that you follow. And then I remember speaking to a woman in Las Vegas who was looking at our materials, thinking about this. And she's like, I honestly don't really care. I just want my kids to do what makes them feel best in the moment. But that's the conversation she needs to have with them. Otherwise, they're just thinking, Mom never told us. We've never talked to her. We don't know. And maybe they're in disagreement with each other. Whereas her goal, what matters most to her, is that you two be on the same page. You can decide what you think is best in the moment. So our conversation prompts and guides are not meant to be a script. They're meant to provoke an idea of what might work for somebody. But I think it's all going to look unique for each group who might be having this conversation.
And I think that the interesting thing is I'm hearing you is a lot of conversations about end of life, perhaps, and maybe this is my own personal experience, is what to do with stuff. Like that's the, please let me know what you want to do with the things or not do with the things or things like that. Or even I think back to before I lost my father is he was like, here are these material things in case, like, here's where the key is and here's where this other stuff is, the papers, right? So it's more about the things and it's more about, quote unquote, the business after. But I think these conversations about personal desires and wishes seem to be a little bit more difficult.
Well, I think, again, that idea that you can't anticipate every scenario that could come up. And we wouldn't want people to. Doctors, nurses, people are important. The clinicians are important for helping contribute to some of these conversations. And I think that sometimes the conversations about stuff and money is actually what frees those people about bringing this up. I don't want to bring this up with my mom because I don't want her to think that I'm trying to hurry things along. Or I don't want to offend and imply that I'm trying to get stuff. But this can be so much more about honor and respect and how can I do well by you? And you've made every other big choice in your life, Dad. And I want to be sure that if there was a time or somebody, I remember a friend whose dad is just like, if I'm blinking, I'm in there trying to come out. I want you to do every possible thing. Okay, help me understand if you couldn't speak for yourself. What does doing everything look like? What are you fighting for? What do I need to understand about that so that we can get some clarity? I think a lot of people think that the people in their life just automatically would know what they want. And yet, if you're grieving the future loss of your person, that's a really hard time to learn. I also think it's important to note for some people, these conversations are about the care of somebody who they don't have a very loving relationship with. I try not to use the phrase loved ones because I know that can be a loaded term. That's not always the case. People's family of origin, there could be a whole host of issues, and yet we may be responsible for somebody in our life that has not always been a positive relationship. That's worth noting that can be an important dynamic to address. There's a lot of solo agers. That's a really growing population of folks who are growing older and don't have a spouse or adult children, and they're trying to think about who could I trust with this conversation. Yeah, I think it does require a little thinking and acknowledging of life, and yet we know that people feel a lot of relief after having these conversations, and that the depression rates for people after the loss of somebody important in their life 6 months later are much lower for those who've had these conversations than those who haven't. Again, because there's less complex or complicated dynamics of the survivors or second guessing yourself or wondering what may have happened. So that's what I'm really drawn to this work for.
No, I absolutely recognize that. And even just having the conversations again, if we do lose someone that we cared about and we feel regret for not having a conversation, perhaps if we lost them suddenly, this is a way to at least avoid a portion of that regret. Another initiative that you're involved with is promoting the National Healthcare Decisions Day, which is April 16th of every year. This is similarly associated with ensuring that those we care about understand our thoughts and opinions about our own end-of-life care. So what can you tell us about NHDD?
Yeah, so this was set up, it was 2008, by an attorney, Nathan Kottkamp, who saw too many of these conversations not happening. And he chose April 16th every year as a little bit of a joke to a Benjamin Franklin quote, that nothing is certain in life but death and taxes. So the day after tax day every day, it's again this idea that this can be something we revisit annually. It's like changing your batteries on your smoke detector or getting your oil changed. Like this is just part of adult life. We make sure that at least once a year we've revisited, is this still the person I want to be my proxy? Do I need to have an updated conversation with them? That idea of a natural point every year in the calendar where there's an excuse almost to bring this up and to do it and not have to wait for some big awkward moment. And so thousands of groups around the country now are doing National Healthcare Decisions Day activities in April. It's now gone from April 16th to the week of April 16th to the month of April. States are issuing proclamations about South Carolina Healthcare Decision Day. But it's a really neat way that we've seen of groups bringing this concept to where they live, work, pray, learn, exercise, whatever that may be. A lot of congregations introducing this, local libraries, alumni groups who are saying, yeah, we have a meeting every month and the April one could be about this, or giving an annual punctuation point, if you will, to help this stay top of mind for people.
And so you've mentioned that you have a number of different resources available, both for the Conversation Project. I almost said the Conversations Project. You got me thinking about it, right?
Yeah.
But both for the Conversation Project and for National Healthcare Decisions Day, you've got a number of resources for individuals that might want to engage in this.
I mentioned earlier, everything we have is free, and we have a Creative Commons license on everything. So it's not copyrighted that you can't take it. We have everybody from like Nancy Nurse, the retired ICU nurse who saw how important this was in her professional career, to clergy, to chaplain, all different types of people who say, I want to bring this to my community. And that might be my book group. It might be my town. It could be a county. And so we've tried to package up as many resources as possible to make it easier for people to do this and kind of volunteer within their community. Some people have turned it into entire professions. They now have learned how to do this and they can do coaching in their community and help others. But we have sample slides and agendas and how could you do this programming in your community, calls to make it easier for people. We had a great call on engaging veterans in community. We're a very small team, and we also know that we are not the only messengers that should or could get the word out. Whether I mentioned we have a bunch of language translations, there's a lot of folks where the messenger would be better not in English. And my Spanish is okay, but not good enough to do this presentation. So we've got Spanish resources for people. Thinking about within your community, who is really locally, and could you get them to have this conversation? I remember in Hawaii, a local radio program did it, and a senator talked about what they had done and what they were going through in their life, because there's a lot of people who are in a caregiving role. I think a lot of employers have realized this too. NHGD is popular with employers who say, our employees, many of them are caregivers when they go home, and this is a service that we can help them be familiar with. Brown bag lunches, resources for employees. I can't remember. It was a car manufacturer who required a lot of their employees to do their advanced care planning when they started their jobs, because they had a lot of young folks who came. They just moved away from home. They were the next of kin in the state, was basically their employer. And so to acknowledge, if something happens, we want you to think about this. And so that's been so exciting to me over the last 10 plus years, is just to see how many more settings are realizing this is for me. This is applicable to the people that I serve. Again, not just lawyers and doctors, but financial planners, clergy, homeowners associations, prison systems. It's been so exciting to see the types of groups, pickleball groups, who are like getting together and talking about this. A lot of people are going to be more moved by hearing about a friend or somebody they know who's had the conversation or how it went for them. So we're just trying to help make that easier for folks.
No, I think that's great. So if folks wanted to access those resources or find out more about both the Conversation Project or the National Healthcare Decision Day, how can they do that?
I think the conversationproject.org is going to be your easiest one-stop shop. That's where we have all of our free guides. You can see a map of where people are in the country. If you're interested in doing this in your community, there's a lot of the resources for National Healthcare Decision Day. To follow us on social media. That's something we're also trying to do, is break things into little bite-sized pieces and videos and get content out. So we'd love if people followed us there, or our contact information is on the website. You can reach out if you have any specific questions that we can help with. We get individuals asking questions. How do I do this? My mom doesn't want to talk about it. What tips do you have? All the way to people who are interested in bringing this out to their county and want to do that.
That's excellent. Now make sure all of the links to all of those resources are in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Once again, we would like to thank this week's partner, PsychArmor. PsychArmor is the premier education and learning ecosystem specializing in military culture content. PsychArmor offers an online e-learning laboratory that's free to individual learners, as well as custom training options for organizations. I'm glad to have been able to highlight the work that Kate is doing and share the Conversation Project with you. As a service member, I know that this was something that was discussed, maybe not frequently when I was in the military, but at least more often than when I've been out of the military. Before deployments, especially before combat deployments, you'd have to make out your will, so there was a formal point to having these conversations. But I also recall having informal conversations with my spouse. what I want if I'm catastrophically injured but not killed, my preferences, what she would want. They weren't always the easiest conversations to have, especially as we don't want to think about not being with someone that we care about, but we also knew it was necessary. As I reflected on my conversation with Kate, however, I realized that this isn't something that we've talked about with as much frequency since I've retired from the military. It's only been at crisis moments or moments of loss, like when my father-in-law passed away in 2010 or my father passed away in 2017. I've often said service members and veterans are more aware of their own mortality and often have very strong opinions about what the end of their life should look like. There's even the famous dark humor related to death and dying that service members often adopt that's somewhat out of the norm for people who aren't in an inherently dangerous occupation. I've had the privilege several times to attend talks by Dr. Irvin Yalom, a well-known expert in existential psychology. During one of the discussions, Dr. Yalom said that death and dying is often a topic that's avoided in therapy. With all respect and appreciation in the world to him, my experience in working with veterans is that death and dying is a frequent, if not constant, topic of discussion for the veterans I worked with as a mental health professional. Again, not because it's always so imminent or a current possibility, although that is sometimes the case, but because death is so present in the lives of those who served, battle buddies that have been lost, or others that they served with who are struggling with health issues related to service, being connected with friends and colleagues who have experienced loss themselves. I often describe it as a doomsday clock. You know, the hypothetical clock somewhere in Europe that indicates how close the world is to ending as a result of climate change or nuclear war or other global catastrophes. In my conceptualization, I think that we each have an internal doomsday clock, an awareness of how close each of us individually are to our own death. The personal awareness fluctuates over time, and in times of extreme danger, we all know that we're 90 seconds from midnight, so to speak. But in my experience, those of us who served, and especially served in combat, live life a little closer to midnight, with more of an awareness of our own mortality than those who may not have had these experiences. You know, I feel like I should have some somber or ominous music playing in the background, but that would defeat the purpose of my conversation with Kate. It's not a somber or ominous thing, but instead should be a very natural and common thing. And it doesn't have to be a constant rumination on the potential of our death, but a very real conversation about what our preferences are. My family's considering an upcoming move to another state, and we're house hunting. You can imagine how many conversations we're having about personal preferences, what compromises we're willing to make or not willing to make. We have these conversations about the future all the time in our lives. Where we want to go to dinner for an upcoming celebration and what our preferences are. Where we want to go for vacation and what our preferences are there. Where we want to go to school to get a degree and what we want from that. But yet, when it comes to a discussion about what our preferences are regarding end of life, we suddenly want to avoid the discussion and not communicate our preferences. So if this episode has sparked an idea in you to have a conversation with those in your life who may be involved in these decisions, then act on it. You can also share this episode and the Conversation Project website with those that you're working with. You never know when it might be beneficial. So I hope you appreciated my conversation with Kate. If you did, we'd appreciate hearing from you. Drop a review in your podcast player of choice or send us an email at info@psycharmor.org. For this week's PsychArmor Resource of the Week, I'd like to share the PsychArmor course, Caring for Veterans Through End of Life, Caregivers and Loved Ones. In this course, you will learn how to support and care for veterans as they near the end of their lives. We'll explore the impact of the final journey on caregivers and loved ones and the importance of planning and respite care. We will discuss how a veteran's service in different eras may impact their care and the unique challenges faced by caregivers and loved ones in the grieving process. By the end of this course, you will have the knowledge and skills necessary to provide compassionate care and support to veterans and their families during this important time. You find a link to the course in our show notes. So thanks again for taking the time to listen to this episode. Make sure to take a look at the show notes, which you can find in the podcast app, as well as on the PsychArmor website at psycharmor.org/podcast. While you're there, you can find hundreds of online training videos delivered by nationally recognized subject matter experts who are all committed to educating the non-military community about military culture. All of these courses are free to individual learners. You wouldn't be listening if you didn't care, and it's that curiosity and passion for supporting service members, veterans, and their families that we want to encourage and increase. Come back each week for another conversation and make sure to engage with PsychArmor on social media to let us know what you thought about the show. I'd like to express special thanks to Operation Encore and Navy Seahawk pilot Jerry Maniscalco for our theme song, Don't Kill the Messenger. This show was produced by Headspace and Timing, and all rights to the show remain reserved by PsychArmor. Much appreciation to the team at PsychArmor that makes this show happen. Carol Turner, Vice President of Strategic Communications, who keeps me on track and is an outstanding guest coordinator, and support and transcript by Emma Atherall. Feel free to share the show. In fact, we request that you do, but make sure to let folks know where you heard it. Join us next time for another great episode, and until then, stay aware, get educated, and be well.